Joining me on the line is Ray Abilea, the Middle East coordinator for Code Pink, a peace and social justice organization. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Now, for the benefit of the listeners, could you explain to them what exactly is Code Pink?
Code Pink is a women-initiated peace and justice organization. We work to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and to end the U.S.-funded occupation of Palestine. We started back in 2003. The name Code Pink is a creative, humorous response to then-President Bush's color-coded terror alerts, Code Red, Code Orange, Code Yellow, Code Terror, and so on. A group of women got together and said, we're not going to live in fear. We're going to be Code Pink for peace. And we've been protesting these illegal wars and occupations ever since, and also working to redirect our financial resources, our precious taxpayer dollars, into life-affirming activities like healthcare, education, and green jobs, and away from the bloated Pentagon military defense budget.
The military, industrial, financial, so on and so forth complex, sure. Now, again, for the benefit of the listeners, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, who are they? What's wrong with them?
So AIPAC is the largest of the right-wing pro-Israeli government lobby groups in the United States, and an argument could be made that they're actually a lobby group on behalf of a foreign government, which would mean they would need to register as a foreign agent, actually. But as it stands today, they're recognized as an official lobbyist in Washington. This is a powerful lobby. Why is it powerful? Well, it is able to galvanize individuals and subsidiary lobbyists to give a huge amount of money to elected officials. That size of money oftentimes can make or break whether these elected officials get elected or not. So they maintain a stranglehold on our Congress, and they proceed to lobby on three main points. The primary point is more military aid to Israel. And the military aid is our tax dollars that are being spent on weapons and munitions that go to support the illegal siege of Gaza and the occupation of the West Bank. They are in Congress almost every day lobbying. In many cases, AIPAC officials also help to write legislation that ultimately often gets passed. So this is a lobby that's dictating our policy vis-a-vis the Middle East and specifically Israel and Palestine. And
right.
I think it's very dangerous given that we don't have campaign finance reform in this country. They're able to give tremendous amounts of money, and politicians are therefore afraid to speak out on this issue, even though often supporting this cause of the Israeli occupation is contrary to U.S. law, to international human rights law, to the Geneva Conventions, and so on. And even contradictory to the congresspeople's own commentary on a variety of other issues.
Right. And of course, you were talking about registration, and you were alluding to the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, which requires that any organization that is lobbying on the behalf of a foreign government has to be registered. And there's a lot of documentation about how AIPAC has been able to skirt that. And of course, that's a conversation for another day. Ray, you were in the news recently. I read online that you have filed a lawsuit against some, I guess, unnamed folks who had roughed you up at the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to Congress. When did that happen, that event?
Netanyahu addressed the joint session of Congress on May 24th, earlier this year, and that was on the heels of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's annual policy conference in D.C. So listeners might remember when the Israeli Prime Minister came to the U.S. for a visit and he did back-to-back talks. He met with President Obama, then he gave the keynote address at the AIPAC conference, and then spoke to a joint session of Congress that Tuesday.
Okay. The speech that Netanyahu gave to Congress, that was much publicized in the news, primarily for the fact that there were ostensibly 29 standing ovations that Congress gave this fella. Were you there for that?
Yes, I was in the House gallery during that speech. And what's amazing about the number of ovations is that Netanyahu received more standing ovations than our own President Obama received during his State of the Union address. So there was this bipartisan, tremendous support for a leader of another country that maintains an illegal occupation, that also maintains laws that enforce segregation, what we in the United States would call separate but equal, which we know is always unequal. And I was in the gallery at the time when he was giving this speech, and I was really appalled to see how much support he was getting. Getting into the room to be present in the Capitol in D.C. was not easy. Each congressperson only received received one ticket for the gallery, and they could give that to a supporter, a friend, a family member, a staffer, or a lobbyist of their choosing. Each person that received a ticket had to fill out special forms with the DC Capitol Police, the Sergeant at Arms, to receive a security background clearance check to get into the Capitol, and we all had assigned seating. So I was very fortunate through Code Pink to be able to secure a ticket to get into this high-profile event and be able to bear witness to history in the making, so to speak, and then to make some history of my own by speaking out against the Israeli government's injustices towards Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, you said that each congressperson was only allowed one ticket. Was that dictated by Congress or was that dictated by AIPAC?
That's dictated by Congress. As far as I know, that is only the case when there's a joint session of Congress hearing a head of state speak. Otherwise, on normal congressional proceeding days, oftentimes your average tourist or visitor to the Capitol is able to get a ticket from their congressperson and there's no problem getting in. This was just a much more high profile and in demand event. And I was actually pretty surprised, and this might sound naive, but to walk in and see most people in the gallery to me seem to be wearing the AIPAC badges from their conference, which had just happened that weekend. And it was just a visual evidence of the stranglehold that AIPAC holds on our Congress.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe the 29 standing ovations have a direct correlation to the money that AIPAC gives to U.S. politicians?
Definitely. This kind of unrelenting support and blind support for another country is very hard to find another example of that in our U.S. foreign policy. Any criticism of the Israeli government is viewed as anti-Semitic or even un-American or unfriendly, and we don't see that in relationship to almost any other country.
Right. And you yourself, are you Jewish?
I am, yeah, born and raised Jewish. My dad was an Israeli citizen born in Israel, and my father's family is from there. And I have a very strong connection today to my active Jewish community in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. So you've actually been to Israel several times?
I have. I traveled to Israel first in high school with several delegations that I think would be kind of the equivalent of Birthright. Birthright is a free trip for young Jews to see the wonders of Israel, so to speak. I think these kinds of trips often are very much propaganda to sell the idea that Israel is wonderful, it can do no wrong, and it's full of beautiful historic sites, fun discos, and exciting water parks, and really don't talk about the Palestinian plight or the inequality in Israel proper at all whatsoever. So I really haven't been active on this issue until the end of 2008 when I witnessed the crippling Israeli assault on Gaza that left 1,400 people killed and many more injured or homeless. I was shocked, and it was just very apparent to me then that Israel's offensive on Gaza was completely disproportionate to any kind of violence they might be receiving from the small rocket attacks. And I myself and Code Pink as an organization condemn violence on all sides and seek to look for a more diplomatic or peaceful solution, but it just became so apparent that this is the situation of occupation and oppression. And I was really grateful that at that time Code Pink began working on this issue more seriously. Since 2009, we've led 10 delegations into Gaza, delivering humanitarian aid and bearing witness and coming home and telling the stories of our experiences in the U.S. and throughout Europe. We've also launched many campaigns in the U.S. to pressure Congress to lift the siege, to pressure Israel to lift the siege. We've been part of the flotilla efforts to try to break the siege by water. And we've also launched our own campaign to boycott Ahava Cosmetics, which are made in an illegal Israeli settlement. And that's part of the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which I think is also a really inspiring way to take action and to put your money where your values are and to work to pressure the Israeli government to uphold international law. So mm-hmm. We've been very active on this issue, and taking on AIPAC was just another piece of the puzzle of saying, you know, it's one thing to keep asking our Congress people to do the right thing, and I think calling Congress and congressional visits is really important. At the same time, it can feel like we're banging our heads against the wall because we're not making any headway, and we have to ask ourselves why. And when we see that Congress is being fueled and funded by this massive lobby group, we have to take a look at the money behind the power. And I'm really, really glad we took on AIPAC. And also asking the U.S. government to stop giving military aid to Israel is in alignment with the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that's also known as the BDS movement. How do you spell that cosmetic company?
It's spelled A-H-A-V-A, Ahava, and Ahava in Hebrew means love, but we say there's no love in occupation. This is a company right. that has its main manufacturing plant in a settlement called Mitzvah Shalem, and also Kibbutz Kalia, and this company uses mineral mud from the part of the Dead Sea that's in the occupied territories in its products, and so that would be labeled as pillage under the Geneva Convention. So they're breaking multiple international laws, and we've actually had a lot of successes in the very short term of this campaign. Many stores have decided to stop carrying the product. We've gotten a direct response from the CEO, and even their spokesmodel, Kristen Davis, the former star of Sex and the City, stopped shilling for them and is no longer their model.
That's very great. Congratulations. Are these the folks that are in malls, the Dead Sea Cosmetics, is that them? They have
for
little
the most
kiosks?
Part, those kiosks are actually a different company. The kiosks that are usually womaned by Israeli young women
yes.
Is a different kind of Dead Sea products, and most of those products are made in Israel proper. So it's a little bit of a different issue. But you can find Ahava Cosmetics usually sold in Bed Bath & Beyond, in some Nordstrom stores, and in Lord & Taylor's and other big chains around the country. And I'd encourage listeners to, if you see it being sold, ask the store manager to stop carrying it and check out our website, stolenbeauty.org, to find other ways of engaging with store owners and helping them make an ethical choice and stopping supporting the occupation.
That's great. And of course, you said you didn't get actively involved in this issue until 2008, and you're alluding to, I guess, Operation Cast Lead, which really had that similar impact on a lot of people who didn't understand what this occupation was all about. So that affected a lot of people, I've found, over the years.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to admit that it took me that long to get involved, but I think that there's a lot of unlearning that I've had to do about what I grew up believing about Israel, and it's still out of love for Israel and out of love for the land that I take the actions that I do today, and also out of a reconnecting for my ancestry. And in doing this work and having my name be so public in it, I've received lots of emails from people who knew my great uncle, Joseph Abalea, and Joseph was one of the first conscientious objectors in Israel in 1948 when the state was created. He was a musician who wanted to play music with everyone and had many Arab and Palestinian friends and really believed in unity state and living in harmony with each other side by side and not having this religious and national segregation.
So I guess it's in your blood, we could say.
I think it is. Yes.
Now getting back to May 24th, that was the date, right?
Yes.
Did you happen to count the standing ovations? It was 29, right? Or did you not pay attention to that?
I unfortunately didn't hear all of those standing ovations because I was tackled, manhandled, and then dragged out of the hall before the end of the speech.
Right. Besides Congress, was everybody else standing?
Yes. Yes.
Did you stand?
I've done a few disruptions in my time as an activist, and I know that if you're planning to speak out in an event, you don't want to call attention to yourself before you do that.
Okay, so you played along. What were they actually applauding about? Did you notice some of the things? Was it anything? He opened his mouth, he raised an eyebrow, and they got up and they started applauding. Was there something specific that they were applauding about?
Yeah, I would say in general, these speeches have very short sentences and people like to applaud after almost every single one. One of the things early on was Netanyahu asserted again and again that basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, Israel is the best friend of the United States and the United States is the best friend of Israel. You know, that these are allies and brothers in arms that have each other's back in all circumstances. And I remember Congress applauding very loudly to that. Now, the moment when I stood up was when Netanyahu was actually applauding the young people in the Middle East who were standing up for democracy. And at that time, back in May, he was talking about the Egyptians and possibly the Tunisians as well, who were leading these nonviolent popular uprisings. And as a young person myself, I'm 28 years old, that seemed like my cue to stand up and also speak out for democracy. I see Netanyahu as a political leader who is denying direct democracy to the Palestinian people, both living in Israel and also in the West Bank and in Gaza, and someone who is impeding freedom and liberation for a whole population of people, whether it's the 1.5 million people living under basically an open-air prison inside of Gaza or the constant curtailing of freedom of speech for people that dare to speak out against his administration. Listeners might not know that even doing things like commemorating the Nakba, the great catastrophe, the date in 1948 when Israel became a state and many Palestinians were forcibly exiled from their homes into refugee camps, is actually illegal in Israel. So there's all this curtailing of rights and freedom of speech, and I felt it was my duty to call out Netanyahu on that issue.
And of course, the irony is right there for everybody to see, where Netanyahu is honoring these young people for standing up to these despots and trying to spread democracy. And there you are trying to do that. And of course, they tackled you. How far away are you from Netanyahu? A couple hundred feet, you think?
Yeah, I was in the gallery. The gallery is the second tier of the Capitol building. It's a round building. Listeners probably saw it maybe even tonight on the news with Obama speaking about the economy. So it's the second level up, and I was in the back row of the gallery. I was only a few rows away from Netanyahu's wife, actually.
Ah, her name's Sarah, I believe, right?
Yeah. So it's actually a pretty big room with interesting acoustics. So to have your message heard, you do need to project your voice pretty loudly.
Mm-hmm. So he starts talking about these young people. Run through exactly what happened, if you remember.
I stood up and unfurled a banner that said, "Occupying land is indefensible." That was referring to Netanyahu's comments that the 1967 borders are indefensible. And I was trying to use that word and turn it on its head and say, no, what's really indefensible is breaking international law, continuing to expand settlements, to occupy land. And I shouted from the Congressional Gallery, "Stop Israeli war crimes, equal rights for Palestinians, occupying land is indefensible." And I repeatedly said these things, and a man grabbed my arm, tried to rip the banner out of my hand, kind of sent me whirling, and I fell to the right, and also attempted to gag me, and I felt people pushing me from around me, and a lot of the details of my experience are highlighted in this lawsuit that I've just launched against the people who assaulted me. But I was very badly manhandled and couldn't actually get up on my own accord to walk out of the room when the security wanted to pull me out for disrupting Congress. So the police dragged me out by my arms, and I was taken to the basement of the Congress building, where I immediately asked for medical attention. I could just tell there was something not right with my neck, and my head was pounding, and I knew that I had been pretty badly injured at that point. And so they called for medical care, and I was taken to a hospital in D.C. nearby and had a lot of tests and x-rays done. And in the middle of one of the tests, a few hours later, police came in and randomly read me my Miranda rights and said I was under arrest, and I felt like maybe I was in some kind of telenovela or soap opera where I'm being arrested in the middle of a hospital and handcuffed to the hospital bed. And from that point on, I had two police officers who were watching me my every move, even though, mind you, I had an IV in the whole time. I really didn't believe that I was the most dangerous person for speaking out for peace and justice and being a peaceful protester, but they made out to believe I was some kind of criminal. And I was taken to the police house after that and charged and arrested for disruption of Congress. And my injuries were mostly muscle strain, shoulder strain, neck strain, and was given heavy-duty painkillers and told that it was kind of an extreme version of a whiplash. And then began this tremendous media storm and flood of thank yous from all over the world for speaking out and giving voice during this crucial moment. I think a lot of people were able to hear me disrupt, and I received so many messages and tweets and text messages from people all over the world, and it was really exciting to feel the strength of this movement that I'm part of, to feel that this movement, it's not just on college campuses, it's not just in alternative media, it's not just in the U.S. or Europe or the Middle East, it's everywhere. And it's growing every day. And it was really amazing to get just a little taste of that by how many appreciations I got, which far outweighed the few and far between hate messages that I did receive. And I especially appreciated getting so much support, of course, from the Palestinian community, but also from the Jewish community, from people that said, you know, thank you for saying what you did. You're giving me courage to speak out. Because I think there is, in the Jewish community, still this palpable culture of silence, where people are afraid to speak out. They're afraid that they'll be shunned by their synagogue community or fired from their Jewish jobs or put down by their families. There's just a lot of fear of speaking out. And so I'm grateful that my voice got to be present there. And I know that it's not really about me. I'm just the one voice that got through in that moment. And I'm one voice of millions who are taking action for justice on this issue. And on that point, I should mention that the night before I disrupted, Netanyahu gave a keynote address address at the AIPAC Gala, which is a dinner event for 10,000 people at the D.C. Convention Center. And in the middle of his very hawkish speech, five different activists at different moments in his speech stood up. Two of them actually stood on the banquet tables, unfurling banners about what is indefensible about Israel's policies, whether it's the starvation of Gaza or the expansion of settlements, and spoke out. And a few of them were actually pretty badly injured as well by members of the AIPAC attendee audience who pushed them to the ground, grabbed them. One of the women, who's only 21 years old, she was interning with Code Pink at the time, Chelsea Byers, her whole body was covered with bruises after this incident. And to me, this kind of violent response to nonviolent protesters, to peaceful demonstrators, is a microcosm of what goes on almost every day in the West Bank. We know that about the weekly demonstrations on Fridays in the Palestinian villages of Bil'in, Nu'in, Nabi Saleh, where people march peacefully, sometimes with children flying kites or clowns, and they do these peaceful marches and they get responded to by the Israeli Defense Forces with tear gas and rubber bullets and sometimes live ammunition that results in death or serious injury. And this is the standard norm for people espousing this political worldview, and it's completely unacceptable. As Americans, we remember the history of the dogs and the water cannons that were used on African Americans during the civil rights movement.
Sure.
And I think that we're seeing a similar kind of violent force used against nonviolent protesters in this issue.
Sure. And of course, it's not just the IDF, but it's the settlers themselves who are armed to the teeth, a lot of them, who are firing.
That's right. And I think we really need to keep alert and keep an eye out for what's happening in the news right now in Israel and in the West Bank, because settlers are arming for potentially an increase in violence, specifically because of all of the peaceful protests, the tent city, and the movement for economic justice in Israel. One of the ways that Israel can get out of being mired in that domestic conflict is to launch an attack. And I don't know when or where that attack will come, but I think we should definitely be alert to it.
Yes, I'm sure a lot of the listeners would agree with that. Now, when you were talking about how you got all these instant messages, tweets, all these people from all over the world, which is, that's amazing. It sounds like, really, the clock may be ticking for AIPAC and even for Israel's illegal occupation. Would you agree with that?
I think the clock is definitely ticking, and inshallah, I hope that we will see peace and justice come to the region in our lifetimes. I think that this kind of colonial expansion cannot continue, and we know from the experiences of the end of separate but equal laws in the U.S. or the end of apartheid in South Africa that these kind of government laws and repression just can't continue forever. When it comes to AIPAC, I think we have a lot of work to do here in the U.S. to educate people, even in our own activist progressive communities, about what the lobby is, what it does, and the influence that it has, because I do see it as a huge target and a huge roadblock to peace in this case. I do think that the United States is one of the last strongholds of supporting and propping up the Israeli government. We see the Turkish government pulling out of its diplomatic relations with Israel and taking a stand, especially after the killing of 9 innocent civilians on a flotilla, the Mavi Marmara, a year ago, trying to get into Gaza. And we also see more and more countries aligning with the Palestinian statehood vote, which is a very complex issue, which is being strongly debated in the Palestinian community. But the support for statehood does indicate a shift in foreign governments' relationships to Palestine. And we also see increasing successes in the boycott and divestment movement, where corporations and companies are getting a message that it's no longer profitable to do business with the occupation. And one of the best examples of that is the case of Veolia, which is a transport, waste, and water management company that was forced to pull out of a big multi-billion dollar contract to build a light rail between Jerusalem and the settlements, because so many European municipalities dropped their contracts with Veolia and said, if you're going to do dirty business that violates international law, we're not going to do business with you. And they lost $15 billion and said, okay, enough is enough. This isn't financially advantageous for us anymore. And I think more and more people are getting that idea.
For somebody who only recently learned about this issue, you seem to have a very firm grasp on all of the elements of it. It's very impressive.
Well, I'm grateful that I get to do this work and be of service to the movement, and I think I have a lot to learn about the history and about all of the different movements around the country, and I also think we have a lot to learn from other social movements, especially right now from the Arab Spring and the overthrowing of Mubarak in Egypt and the uprisings throughout the world. And I think there's also a lot we can even learn from the Israeli tent cities. I certainly don't see massive tent cities happening here in the U.S. when our economy is crippled and weak and people don't have jobs, their homes are being foreclosed. And I think we here at home, we need to also connect the dots to the cost of war and occupation and that $3 billion in military aid that we're giving to Israel every year.
Right, at least 3 million. Some people calculate it to be a lot higher. Now, I'm looking at that photo that was snapped of this. It's like a perhaps a guy in his 60s who is grabbing the banner. How long did you have the banner up before this guy became aggressive?
I would say it was a matter of seconds. It was not a lot of time at all. Of course, in these actions, the shortest amount of time feels like a long time. And my objective was to make my voice as loud and clear as possible and to be a channel for the message that I wanted to give that day about human rights and justice. So I was not necessarily paying attention to timing or what was happening around me. And that's why I've had to go back and really reconstruct and write down, you know, my testimony of how I was hurt and injured.
And this is for the lawsuit. So tell our listeners about the lawsuit. Did you decide to sue right away? Is it something that came afterwards? Did somebody suggest that you sue, or was it your idea?
Well, I've been trying to press charges with the police, and I do believe that the police did interview the people who assaulted me right after the incident. And I feel like it's just really important to hold people who are committing violence like this accountable for the well-being of future activists, so that people know that when they protest, they have free speech and that their rights are protected. So that's why I feel like this case is so important. And then secondarily, it's really important politically, like I said earlier, to illustrate the connection between this kind of violence and the daily violence towards Palestinians in the West Bank. So that level of accountability seems very important. It was not easy to find a legal team that would do this on contingency or pro bono. I obviously am not a millionaire. I don't have money to pay the standard legal fees. And also someone who saw eye to eye with me on my political views. And I was very fortunate to find the law office of Lynn Burnaby. And I'm grateful to be working with her and her staff on making this civil suit. And I also hope that there will be criminal charges that will hold these people accountable once we know their identities.
Mm-hmm. This attorney is doing this pro bono?
Yeah, it's what's called on contingency, which means that the legal team gets a cut of whatever a settlement will be if there is one.
If there is one. And if there isn't one, then that's fine. So they're doing this for reasons that kind of align with yours.
Yeah, because it's the right thing to do, because it's a rule of law, and law needs to be upheld, and people shouldn't be able to get away with violent acts like that.
Absolutely not. You had the banner up probably for, I would say, based on how many times you said what you were saying, not more than 15 seconds. He leapt over one other person, or two other people, it looks like, grabbed it. How tall are you?
I'm almost 5'8".
Okay, so you're not tiny. So this guy seemed like, at least from the photograph, he had a lot of weight on you. It seems like from the photograph, he's grabbing and pulling you. Did he actually pull you to the floor?
Yeah, and I was kind of jostled into the row of seats in front of me.
Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, he's kind of towing the line of how the Israelis handle the Palestinians. I mean, it is a Netanyahu speech.
I have to say, I wasn't expecting that level of violence inside of the Congress. I mean, this is the sanctuary of our capital, of our government. It's really brightly lit room. Everyone is dressed up in their finest. Not the kind of place you would expect people to go berserk. And one interesting piece is there was a rabbi who was also inside of Congress, sitting a few more seats away from me, Rabbi Shmuley Boteya. He's pretty well known. He wrote a kind of a best-selling book called Kosher Sex. And he wrote a blog post after the incident called To Seize or Not to Seize. And it's his moral dilemma about whether or not to assault me in Congress, which I found kind of amazing, given that he's a rabbi, he's a spiritual leader, that he was having this internal debate about whether or not to use violence to suppress the voice of a peaceful demonstrator. But his political views are very opposite of mine, and his main reason for not assaulting me was because he was worried about his own image, and he said he could see the headlines of, you know, Orthodox rabbi assaults young woman or grabs young woman in Congress, and he was, you know, worried about having that label on him. So he chose not to assault me. But you know, the decision of whether or not to assault someone shouldn't be about ego. It should be about whether or not you believe in law or ethics. I would also note that in Judaism, strongly speaks out against being a bystander to violence. There's, in a way, like a commandment to speak out or do something to prevent violence when you see it happening.
Right. And of course, as you said, especially in that particular room, it seems like this fella,
right,
who I'm sure you're going to find out who he is, I'm sure your legal team will find out who this guy is, but this guy has obviously no respect for Congress. He wouldn't care where he was.
Well, it's interesting because in the Capitol building, of course, there's heavy security. There's a security guard almost every 10 feet. So there certainly was not a need for a civilian to take matters into their own hands.
Well, hopefully he's going to pay the price. The lawsuit was filed in Washington, D.C. District Court. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. What's the next step for your lawsuit?
The next step was to issue a subpoena for discovery of the identities of the people who assaulted me, and my legal team did that about a week and a half ago. They submitted a subpoena for the evidence, and the D.C. Capitol Police have a month to comply with that subpoena. So then we'll take the next step from there. And we think it's important along the way continue to raise public awareness about this case and the issues surrounding it.
Well, I'm sure this interview is going to help with that. They have a month. It was just done last week. They just have a couple of weeks to reply, and they're going to have to cough up the names of these people who jumped you.
That's the goal, yes, and then to take it from there.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this is a process of learning how civil court works and really understanding the process of the legal system to hold people accountable.
Right. And there's four unnamed people, it says this is article, and you're suing for $500,000 in compensatory damages and the same amount in punitive damages for assault, battery, and false imprisonment. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what the legal assault complaint says.
Okay. And then, of course, perhaps when your lawsuit brings out these people's names, there's a possibility that the law enforcement officials will file a criminal case against them. Is that what you're hoping
for? That's possible, yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah.
Ray, if listeners want to keep abreast of your story, this case, where's the best place for them to do that?
So there's several ways to reach me. You can follow me on Twitter at Ray Abilea, RayAbileah, to join Code Pink in our campaigns for justice and peace in Palestine and Israel. You can visit us online at codepink.org. And to find out how to get involved in the movement to expose AIPAC lobby, you can visit moveoverapac.org. And I'd like to invite listeners to join us in D.C. in 2012 at the beginning of March for AIPAC's annual policy conference. We will be having a counter conference and protests outside, and you don't have to wait till March to take action because we have an ongoing campaign to expose AIPAC. And just wanted to briefly mention that this past month in August, 1 in 5 congresspeople went on a AIPAC affiliate junket trip to Israel instead of coming home to their districts to work on the urgent issues around our domestic economy. So we've been doing a lot of investigating into this issue and have found out that the AIPAC affiliate and AIPAC are looking on paper like one and the same organization. And as listeners might know, it is illegal for congresspeople to take money and trips and services from lobbyist groups. And so we have put in a complaint to the Ethics Committee and are looking for this to be reevaluated. And I think this is incredibly unethical for AIPAC to be sending congresspeople on these types of propaganda trips to Israel. So there's lots people can do right now. You can hold your congressperson accountable, find out whether or not they went on one of these junkets at moveoverapac.org, send them a letter, and take action today.
That's great. That's terrific. Ray Abilea, the Middle East coordinator for Code Pink, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and really looking forward to seeing how this lawsuit unfolds and looking forward to speaking to you in the future.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to continuing to be a listener to your show.